So our passage this evening then is Judges chapter 8 as we continue our studies in this Old Testament book. And I mentioned last time then, which was 2 weeks ago now, that when it comes to characters in Old Testament narratives, we need to be careful about the moral judgments that we as readers make. I mean, you think of the culture that we live in. And there are certain sections of the media that are obsessed with the lives of celebrities. It's front page stuff, day in, day out. And it's interesting, isn't it, that those celebrities then, within those media, they tend to be either idolized or demonized. I guess Meghan Markle seems to be in the former category. Just now, the golden girl who wears the right things and says the right things and attends the right things. And celebrities then can be idolized like that. But then, of course, woe betide any celebrity today who happens to make some ill-judged comment or something like that. Ours is such a graceless culture, isn't it? The poor guy is demonized immediately, as well as all the damning headlines, contracts for all sorts of things get ripped up, sponsorship deals get withdrawn. He's now a tarnished brand, well and truly hung out to dry. And it seems to me then that we can easily bring this cultural tendency with us when we consider these Old Testament characters. We make them either heroes or villains, objects of out-and-out commendation on the one hand, or objects of out-and-out condemnation on the other hand. But the situation is often more complex than that. These characters, they have their successes and their failures. They have their vices and their virtues. They have their mountaintops and their dark valleys. And Gideon then is no different. It's interesting actually that in the last little section of the Gideon narrative, verses 29 to 35 of chapter 8 here, his two names are very prominent. So we have Gideon, mentioned three times in those verses, and then we have Jerubbaal mentioned twice in those verses. Perhaps this is the narrator's subtle way of summing the man up. One commentator remarks, the ambivalent character of the man is reflected in this alternation of names. Now I'm beginning this way this evening then, because this evening we are going to be quite hard on Gideon. I think this passage demands it. But I don't want you to go away with the impression then that we're just completely writing off the guy. No, I want us all to be clear that Gideon has his qualities. Gideon has his achievements. Indeed, Gideon, of course, is included, isn't he, in that great list in the New Testament of persons of faith, the list we have in Hebrews chapter 11. So that settles the matter. Gideon is a good guy in one very important sense. He's a man of faith. He's a believer. We shall meet him in the world to come. So the harsh things then that we're going to say about Gideon this evening, they must be set in that broader context. We're not demonizing him. We're not giving him the tabloid treatment. We're simply considering some of the darker aspects of a life which, like your life and like my life, was a right old mixture of different things. So how then does chapter 8 represent the darker aspects of Gideon's life? What exactly are the problems here? Why need we be harsh on Gideon when it comes to Judges 8? What's wrong? Well, once again, I want to focus this evening on one particular section of this passage, which I think everything else in the passage kind of revolves around. This has happened to be my approach in the last couple of sermons on Judges as well, and that's going to be our approach this evening. And so it's what I suppose is the climactic scene, really, of the passage, the one in verses 18 to 21 that we're going to particularly focus on, the killing by Gideon of Zeba and Zalmunna. And focusing then particularly on that fascinating moment in the narrative, I want to highlight three things that Gideon is getting wrong. Three things that Gideon is getting wrong. First of all then, he's pursuing his own mission, not Yahweh's. He's pursuing his own mission, not Yahweh's. So prior then to actually thrusting his sword into these two men, prior to actually killing Zeba and Zalmunna, Gideon first has this fascinating conversation with them, during the course of which we as readers are given an extraordinary new piece of information. The piece of information probably relates to those 7 years during which the Midianites had oppressed Israel, and during which they had regularly invaded the land of Israel. Remember how we saw that at the beginning of chapter 6, how the Midianite oppression was particularly severe for 7 years, and they regularly invaded the land. And presumably then it was while carrying out one of those invasions of the land of Israel that these two men, Zeba and Zalmunna, killed Gideon's brothers. That's the fascinating piece of new information that we're suddenly given. It's mind-blowing. You kind of reel for a moment trying to process this, that Gideon's own brothers had been killed. We didn't know anything about this, but we're discovering it now. And once you do process this new piece of information, it suddenly makes sense of everything that has gone before it in chapter 8. This raging Gideon, dealing so severely with these two cities, the city of Succoth and the city of Penuel. Now, let me just say before we go any further that some commentators think that Gideon is entirely warranted in his actions toward those two Israelite cities. I completely disagree with that, and I do so for the following reasons. Most importantly of all, Gideon's divine mandate that he received back in chapter 6, verse 14, was what? Go and save Israel. Go and save Israel. Now, however you interpret that, however you construe that, it's very hard to fit into the concept of saving Israel what he goes and does to these two cities here in chapter 8. Here we have him torturing and killing Israelites. It's the exact opposite of what he is being commissioned by God to do. I mean, you think of Samson, to whom God willing will come eventually. And I mean, Samson is slow, isn't he, to fulfill his mission against the Philistines. He's far too friendly toward the enemy, wanting even to marry one of them, marry a Philistine woman. But I think it's probably better to be too friendly toward the enemy like Samson than to treat Israel as the enemy, like Gideon does here in chapter 8. At least Samson didn't go around killing the very people whom he had been appointed to save. He was slow to kill Philistines, but once he did, he killed a fair few, and he didn't go around killing Israelites. So that's the most important reason I say this. Then again, you have the contrast with Deborah and Barak back in chapters 4 and 5. And remember how they face the same problem as Gideon faces here, the problem of uncooperative sections within Israel. In fact, for them, for Deborah and Barak, it was whole tribes that were being stubborn and were refusing to come and help in the battle. Here it's just two cities who are refusing to help Gideon as he pursues Zeba and Zalmunna. And what did Deborah and Barak do? Well, they composed that song. And in that song, they strongly criticized those tribes that had stayed at home and refused to cooperate and refused to contribute and help. In one case, they even pronounced a very strong curse against the city of Meroz, wherever that may be, somewhere in Israel, presumably. But they didn't go and wage war on those Israelites that had stayed at home. They didn't go around starting to pull down towers or anything like that. And so Gideon seems to contrast unfavorably with Deborah and Barak. Then again, does this not smack of another Old Testament incident? I'm thinking of an incident in the life of David. I'm thinking of when he wanted provisions from someone in the way that Gideon here wants provisions from the cities of Succoth and Penuel. He wanted provisions for his men from that rich man Nabal, 1 Samuel 25, I think it is. And remember how Nabal was a surly and mean old bird and he refused to cooperate. And the message goes back to David, no, you're not getting any sheep. And remember how he reacts furiously to this. Just like Gideon here, he's full of rage. And remember how he would have gone and wreaked the sort of havoc on Nabal that Gideon wreaks here on these cities, except that Abigail, Nabal's wife, she comes out and she intercepts David and she fulfills that role we were talking about this morning. She's a wonderful peacemaker, isn't she? And she has these brilliantly wise arguments why David shouldn't go ahead with his plan of destroying Nabal and his household. But those wise words then that Abigail speaks there in 1 Samuel 25, they could equally well be spoken to Gideon here. Unfortunately, there's no Abigail in Judges 8. But it kind of smacks of the pre-Abigail encounter David, doesn't it, here? And then one more thing. I think the narrator is perhaps being subtly telling in the opening paragraph of chapter 8. In the opening paragraph of chapter 8, we have the Ephraimites being angry because they weren't part of the original call-up for battle. So they were called up by Gideon once he's pursuing the Midianites. But in the original call-up back in chapter 6, verses 34, 35, that sort of area, he sends messengers to Asher, to Zebulun, to Naphtali, but he doesn't send any messengers to Ephraim. And so the Ephraimites see this as a snub, and they're very offended by this. Now, all the commentators will tell you then that what we have here at the beginning of chapter 8 is the narrator beginning his kind of negative portrait of the tribe of Ephraim, because the tribe of Ephraim is going to feature again in Judges, and it will feature negatively a couple of other times. And so they'll tell you that this is what the narrator's doing here. He's just starting to paint a bleak picture of Ephraim. I think actually his point here is not really to condemn Ephraim. I think his point here is to condemn Gideon by way of contrast, because I think the crucial detail is at the end of verse 3 there, where we're told that once Gideon reasoned with the Ephraimites and said, look, you actually did something very special. You caught the two princes, Oreb and Zeb. Once he reasons with them, what happened? Then their anger against him subsided when he said this. In other words, the Ephraimites there showed precisely the kind of self-control which is so lacking in Gideon himself in the rest of this chapter. Their anger subsided. Even the Ephraimites, who are painted so negatively in the rest of the book, even the Ephraimites saw reason and their anger subsided. Gideon, his anger doesn't subside. He's just furious and raging throughout the rest of this chapter. And so I'm saying then that this excessive rage, this inordinate anger that's driving Gideon throughout the first half of chapter 8, it suddenly makes sense when we come to this scene with Zeba and Zalmunna, and we discover that Zeba and Zalmunna had earlier murdered Gideon's brothers. And so, in other words then, the lack of cooperation by Succoth and Penuel, it angers Gideon so much because he's so desperate to get Zeba and Zalmunna. And he's so desperate to get Zeba and Zalmunna because he wants to avenge his own brother's deaths. And that may be very understandable, a very understandable impulse in Gideon. But you see what I mean by my first heading now, that he's pursuing his own mission now, not Yahweh's. Yahweh's mission was about saving Israel. Gideon's mission has become about executing revenge. And executing revenge, even if that means undermining the divine mission and killing instead of saving Israelite cities. It's why I think Yahweh is so conspicuous by his absence here in chapter 8. I mean, verse 12 is fascinating, isn't it? This is where he actually gets his hands on Zeba and Zalmunna. We read, Zeba and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic. Now that's a classic kind of verse where in previous passages you would have had Yahweh mentioned, Yahweh threw the army into a panic. Now that's how it's been described, isn't it, in previous passages. You think of the Deborah and Barak passage, that Yahweh routed the enemy. But here is no reference to Yahweh. It's Gideon who's capturing them. It's Gideon who's doing it all. Which, by the way, doesn't mean that there's no success, which itself is perhaps a telling, quite a frightening point, that Yahweh can be absent and you can still be very successful. It's frightening when applied to the life of churches, isn't it? Yahweh can be absent and you can still be very successful by some criteria. Gideon's successful here. He captures these guys. But it doesn't look like Yahweh's involved in the same way that he has been in the past. And it's a subtle shift then, isn't it, that we're talking about here? Because, of course, in and of itself, pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna is reasonable enough. I mean, he has been commissioned to save Israel from the Midianites, and Zeba and Zalmunna are Midianites, and so it's fair enough to want to completely wipe out all the remnants of the Midianites and not leave these two guys still at large. It's reasonable enough what he's doing in and of itself, but it's the motive that has changed. And we've got to be so careful, haven't we, that when we're pursuing good ends, as Gideon was kind of pursuing good ends here, when we're pursuing good ends, we've got to make sure we are pursuing them as Yahweh's mission and not as our own mission. So, for example, we can be anti-homosexuality and anti-abortion in a very orthodox way, but out of a social conservatism, effectively, rather than out of a real commitment to biblical ethics. And it's evident in our blind spots, the fact that we're not so bothered about other evils like people trafficking or like governments in African countries being corrupt and swallowing up all the aid and not distributing it to their people. We can be against the Islamization of the United Kingdom, but basically because of our political views on immigration, rather than out of a real concern for people's eternal welfare. And again, it becomes evident in blind spots that we find it so much worse when a former church building is turned into a mosque than when perhaps it's turned into a nightclub or something. We can pray for revival, but really because we just don't like the idea of us Christians in the UK being so marginalised and being so much on the sidelines. We want to be at the top table again like we used to be as Christians in the good old days, rather than because we want Jesus Christ to be more widely praised in our land. There can be this shift, can't there, of motive, whereby we're pursuing good ends, but we're pursuing our own mission rather than Yahweh's. So that's the first thing. But then notice with me secondly, not only is he pursuing his own mission, not Yahweh's, he's pursuing his own glory, not Yahweh's. He's pursuing his own glory, not Yahweh's. Because it seems to me that there's another reason also why he's so keen to get the better of Ziba and Zalmunna. Yes, definitely in order to avenge his brother's deaths, but I think there's another reason. And the reason is that they are kings. That's a real emphasis, isn't it, throughout this passage? It's mentioned explicitly three times, in verse 5, in verse 12, and in verse 26. In all those verses, it's mentioned explicitly that these guys are kings. They're distinguished from Oreb and Zeb, who were just princes, those guys who were killed at the end of the last chapter. They were important, but they were just princes. These men, Ziba and Zalmunna, they are kings. Well, so what, you say? Well, this is the thing. Gideon, I would put it to you, Gideon fancies himself as a king. And he wants to show then that he is in that kind of league by claiming here a couple of kingly scalps. Now, at this point, you might be saying, no, Dan, you are completely wrong here. You must be wrong, because look at verse 23. In verse 22, the Israelites come and actually say, Gideon, we want you to be our king. And Gideon's reply is, I will not rule over you. And my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. Well, okay, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? But does Gideon mean what he says there? Seems to me that the weight of evidence in our passage suggests that he doesn't mean what he says there. He verbally declines kingship while acting, it seems to me, exactly like a king. And I mean a king in the pagan sense. The model of kingship that was practiced among the pagan nations in his day. Of course, Israel didn't have kingship yet, but it did have a charter for kingship in the law in Deuteronomy 17. But Gideon, I don't mean he's a king in that sense, in a Deuteronomy 17 sense, but he is behaving as a king here in the pagan sense. What do I mean by that? Well, for one thing, he has a harem, doesn't he? Told in verses 30 and 31, he had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives. Not only did he have many wives, but he had a concubine as well, at least one concubine there in Shechem. I mean, that was classic kingly behavior in the ancient Near East. Any king who was worth his salt had a harem, had lots of women in tow. And Gideon behaves like that. Then again, and perhaps most unmistakably of all, there's the name he gives to the son that his concubine bears him. Abimelech. What does Abimelech mean? My father is king. Can't get much more explicit than that. That's the name that Gideon gives to his son. Well, then there's the fact that when he kills Ziba and Zalmunna there in verse 21, we see that he takes their stuff, their kind of kingly trappings. And it's interesting that, again, we have kind of delayed information here. We're told in verse 21 that he takes the crescent ornaments that were on the necks of their camels. But then you go down to verse 26, and it's obvious that he took more than just the crescent ornaments, because we're told there that there are all these earrings that he's given by the Israelites. We'll come to that in due course. Besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, and besides the collars that were around the necks of their camels. So Gideon has taken more than just a few ornaments. He's taken their robes. He's taken their kingly trappings. Now, if he's just avenging his brother's deaths, he doesn't need to do that. But I think Gideon fancies their status. He wants to be like they had been, kings of that order. And then there's verse 29, where we're told Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. Now, if that just means nothing more than it seems to mean, it's the most obvious statement that has ever been written, isn't it? So, I mean, everyone goes and lives in their own house. But the word, the Hebrew verb lived, it's literally sat. He went and sat in his own house, and it's often used in kingly contexts of the Lord sitting on his throne in the Psalm 2. It's used in that sense. Several of the Psalms, it's used of a king sitting to rule, to reign. And I think that may well be what's intended there. So it's more like he went and ruled from his own house. And it seems to me then that it's more than likely that this too was a motive in the killings of Ziba and Zalmunna. And if I'm correct then about Gideon here, it kind of represents another twist, doesn't it, in the tale. Not quite as dramatic as the twist that we've talked about already. We suddenly discover that Gideon had these brothers and they've been killed earlier on by the Midianites. But another fairly dramatic twist, because you go back to chapter 7, verse 2, one of the most important verses, of course, in the whole Gideon narrative, where you remember Gideon is assembling his army for the battle, and the Lord says to him, "The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.'" In other words, then, Yahweh was concerned that at the end of the battle, the Israelites should be focused on God's glory, not on their own glory. That's why they must have, and we talked about this at length last time, that's why they must have such a small army, so that they won't get confused, so that they won't come to the end of the battle and naturally think, "Wow, aren't we amazing?" No, they will get to the end of the battle and be focused on God's glory, not their own. So Yahweh is very concerned about that. And it seems then that on that particular front, things do go according to plan, and with no particular evidence that by the end of the battle, the Israelites aren't focused on anything but God's glory. It's not the Israelites who get it wrong. It's Gideon himself. It's Gideon who, by the end of the story, is focusing on his own glory and wanting to be a king, wanting to be like Ziba and Zalmunna. It's Gideon who is failing the criterion of chapter 7, verse 2, not the Israelites. By the way, notice it's kind of the opposite problem now, isn't it, in Gideon, than the one we noted during his commission back in chapter 6. Remember how there in chapter 6 he's kind of convinced, isn't he, in conversation with Yahweh, he's convinced that he can't possibly attack the Midianites. He can't do this. And we said it's not really humility, it's actually a failure to comprehend that he's got the power of God behind him, and in the power of God he can do it. Well, now he's kind of gone to the opposite extreme, hasn't he? Then he was convinced that he couldn't possibly attack the Midianites. Now he's convinced he can do pretty much anything. And he can chase after two kings and kill them if he wants to. And he can strut his way across the stage of history. He's a big-headed Gideon now. And it's so true to life, isn't it? The way in which we do veer so often ourselves, don't we? From one sin to its kind of opposite on the scale. And we need to be aware of that, don't we? Because we need then to be fighting sin across many fronts, not just one or two predictable fronts where sin will always come at us, because sin will change its tactics. If you understand, I'm personifying sin, but it will change its tactics, and it will come one day from this angle, the next day from the entirely opposite angle. And we need to be vigilant and fighting on many fronts. And this pursuing then of his own glory rather than Yahweh's that seems to have hijacked Gideon now. Is it not a perennial issue for the people of God? Is it not something with which we all have to battle? I was struck arriving here on Wednesday evening that it was so light now that the ground lights out there in the car park hadn't come on. They normally are on when we arrive on a Wednesday, but they hadn't come on because it was light. Was that a problem? Did I rush to the plant room to switch on those ground lights? Well, no. We could see the building fine. And the only purpose that those ground lights have, the sole reason that they exist there in our car park, is in order to light up the building. They don't serve any other good. They don't fulfill any other purpose. They are there to light up the building. And it's the same for us. You and I exist here on planet Earth to floodlight the glory and the majesty and the grandeur of the God who made us. We don't exist to leave a legacy. We don't exist to make a mark. We don't exist to be remembered for generations to come, by generations to come. As we sang in our third hymn, "What is my being but for thee?" Paul understood that, didn't he? Think of him there in Philippians 1, and he's in prison. And there are men who are going around, and they are using his detainment as an opportunity to run him down, it seems, in the churches, from pulpits. And there's Paul, and he can't do anything about it because he's stuck in prison. He's going to be so bitter, surely. He's going to be raging. No, he says, these men, they're preaching out of selfish ambition. But at least they're preaching Christ. There's a bit of Christ coming through when they stand up. There's a lot of criticism of me, but there's a bit of Christ coming through as well. In that, he says, I rejoice. He couldn't care about his own reputation. Couldn't care what they were doing to him and saying about him. If Christ was being preached, to some degree at least, Paul was happy. All he cared about was the glory of Jesus Christ. John Calvin understood it. And it's evident in relation to his burial arrangements. This is what one of his biographers writes. Calvin had given definite instructions for his funeral. Nothing must distinguish it from that of any other citizen. His body was to be sewed into a white shroud and laid in a simple pine coffin. At the grave there were to be neither words nor song. He did not even want a tombstone. Just a few months later, when foreign students desired to visit the place where the reformer's earthly remains rest, the place could no longer be pointed out among fresh mounds. We need to keep forcing ourselves back to this principle, don't we, that Gideon lost sight of. I exist to floodlight the beauty and majesty and glory of God. He's pursuing his own mission, not Yahweh's. He's pursuing his own glory, not Yahweh's. And then just very briefly in the last place, he's pursuing his own peace, not Yahweh's. He's pursuing his own peace, not Yahweh's. Because there are two little details then in this paragraph, verses 18 to 21, that I'm going to subject to a rather risky psychoanalysis. But I'm going to do that, and then, as in my previous point, I'm going to try and back that up from the surrounding passage. Because it seems to me that there are these two little details which perhaps suggest that Gideon here is trying to salve a conscience which knows that what he's doing is not right. His conscience knows that in the killing of Zebra and Zalmunna, not wrong in itself necessarily, but in the killing of Zebra and Zalmunna, he's pursuing his own mission, not Yahweh's. He's pursuing his own glory, not Yahweh's. His conscience knows that, and he is trying to salve his conscience. One detail is the oath that he swears in verse 19, "As the Lord lives, if you had saved them alive, I would not kill you. And considering, as we've already said, how absent Yahweh has been generally in this passage, and how little thought Gideon seems to have given to him. I mean, in the past, we've seen Gideon actually initiating conversation with Yahweh, haven't we, back in chapter 6, the whole fleece thing, which we discussed at length last time. And obviously, there's some ambivalence there. But at least Gideon is taking the initiative and speaking to God. There's no speaking to God here. God just seems to be off his radar until suddenly he kind of swears an oath in Yahweh's name here. Perhaps just to try and make the whole thing sound a bit better to him. Try and convince himself that actually he's doing Yahweh's business after all. And then there's the way in which he delegates, or tries to delegate, the killing. That's a bit odd, isn't it? The way in which he tries to get his son to do it instead, who's obviously fairly young and been given this appalling task to do, and he doesn't do it. But perhaps it's Gideon again just trying to distance himself somewhat from this, because he knows that things aren't right and that he's not acting in complete integrity and propriety here. So those are the two little details. The supporting incident, which it seems to me really backs this up, is the business with the ephod in verses 22 to 28. Where it seems to me it's a case, as Shakespeare would put it, of Gideon protesting too much. That here then, they've asked him to be king, and Gideon says, I won't rule over you, the Lord will rule over you. But as we've seen, really he is ruling over them and wants to rule over them. But just to show that really, 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 it's the Lord who's ruling over them, he's going to make an ephod. Now, an ephod had, we haven't got time to go into this, but it had these associations in the Old Testament of divine revelation, of the Lord kind of revealing his will through the wearing of the ephod. And remember how David later on would call for the ephod in order for revelation to be given from God. So there were these associations of it being a channel of divine revelation. And I think then this is Gideon kind of going over the top to try and make it appear that, oh yes, Yahweh is going to be ruling you, and I'm going to make an ephod so that he's got this very obvious channel by which he can make his will known to you. And it's this kind of over-protesting, over-compensating, because really, he's wanting to rule. And it's his conscience kind of doing this to compensate. And of course, the ephod itself turns out to be a very disastrous business and becomes a snare. It's worshipped. And I just want to finish with this then, that it means by the end of the Gideon story, there are two big objects, aren't there? There in the town of Ophrah. On the one hand, there's this ephod that Gideon has made here. And on the other hand, there's the Lord is Peace altar that Gideon has made back in chapter 6, verse 24. Gideon built an altar to the Lord and called it the Lord is Peace, Yahweh is Peace. To this day, the narrator says, it still stands at Ophrah. So by the end of the story, you have these two objects standing in Ophrah. You have the ephod and you have the Lord is Peace altar. And it seems to me then that they kind of stand for two alternative ways in which we believers can seek peace of conscience in situations of sin. When we have sinned, when we are engaging in some sinful behavior, when there's some sinful habit or practice that we have allowed into our lives. On the one hand, we can go the ephod route and we can keep on clinging to that sin as Gideon does here, he keeps on ruling over Israel for his own glory. We can keep on clinging to the sin, but just up the religion in our lives. That's what the ephod's all about. It's about Gideon kind of just throwing out a huge lump of religion to try and salve his conscience. A big ephod, because that's religious, and that's to do with Yahweh and revelation and all the rest of it. So we can cling on to the sin and just up the religion and turn the religion knob on our dial up a bit. Or we can repentantly go instead to the Lord is Peace altar. Not the Lord is Peace altar, of course, in Ophrah, that's long gone, but the true Lord is Peace altar, Golgotha, where Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace, was sacrificed to create peace between sinners and a holy God. And it's kind of the choice that we're often confronted with. And so often we go the ephod route, don't we, as believers, foolishly. Cling on to the sin, turn up the religion. Let's be those who get rid of the sin and go back to the cross, back to the altar, where true peace of conscience is available to us. It won't work. It doesn't really salve our consciences. It doesn't really give us peace. But just clinging to the sin and doing more religious stuff, going to more meetings, listening to more sermons, praying longer. It doesn't work, all that stuff, when you're clinging on to the sin. Instead, drop the sin via the cross, the altar, where peace for our consciences is so wonderfully available. May God help us. Amen.